Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with politics, primarily of the mayoral variety, as polls open in Boston at 7 a.m. tomorrow. Our colleagues Emily Rooney and Peter Kadzis, both of whom vote in Boston, will also make predictions on a federal government shutdown a week from today. Then we'll ask you, would you sit and watch TV ads if you were paid for your time in free movies and music? One of us might. One definitely would not.
Then the Reverend Eugene Rivers III on the compassion campaign of the new Catholic Pope Francis. Our TV expert Bob Thompson critiques last night's Emmys and the new TV season. Then MIT professor Andrew McAfee on surveillance cameras at the workplace. Is your big bad boss watching you? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's almost election day, Jim.
That is correct, Marjorie. And as a result, it's a big day for, let's say, 11 of the 12 mayoral candidates in Boston as they make their final pitch to voters. It's also turned out to be a big day for the Boston Police Department with news. As you know, the Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis announced he's stepping down earlier this morning. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over local and then some national politics are Emily Rooney and WGBH contributor Peter Kadzis. Good to see you both.
Good morning, Jim, Marjorie.
Good morning.
Great to be here.
You guys are so jealous you can't vote.
As a matter of fact, we
are. I'm terribly jealous. The Brookline Selectmen is just not the same thing. You know what
Jim
I mean?
Jim gets to vote in Cambridge, the wackiest politics in the state.
And the only place that has more candidates in Boston, right? I should say.
That's true. Why don't you tell them about the free dinners you used to go to every night when you were city councilor, Jim?
It's not every night. It was Monday nights, actually. Okay, let's move on, Marjorie.
So who's going to win? Who's going to win? Who's going to come out top two tomorrow?
Well, top two, I'd say John Conley will be one of the two. And my guess is Marty Walsh, although if the efforts to get votes in the Kadzis-Kelly household are any indication. Dan Conley and...
Yes, I'm thinking.
Yeah, Dan Conley
I'm beginning to think Conley and Conley.
Conley and Conley.
Really?
I don't know why.
Endorsed by the Boston Herald. Marjorie, I beat you to it.
They were endorsed by the Boston Herald. That's right. They're always going to keep the name straight.
Why do you think
C-O-N-L-E-Y.
Why do you think Conley and Conley?
I just think that Dan Conley is a known commodity. He stands out for that reason. And he's certainly likable. In certain communities, anyway, not all of them.
He's not that popular in the black community, the minority community. No,
but turnout is going to be low. It'll probably be under 20%,
which is an embarrassment.
Which is disgraceful. I can't believe this. With all the work these candidates have done, all these forums, all these debates, they've been working their butts off. If people can't get out tomorrow and take 15 minutes to go to the polls. It's disgraceful.
But you were saying... Well,
but I was saying that, you know, older, more conservative voters who would, I think, naturally be drawn to Dan Conley, you know, will be the ones going to the polls.
Because they're concerned about crime, you're saying. Is that part of the reason?
And crime. And look, Conley, who was just a couple of years under 60, he's the oldest in the race. Mm-hmm. It could be argued he's the most experienced in the race. One thing no one's really commented on, ourselves included, is the number of 40-somethings running for mayor. There's a real generational aspect to this election.
Conley's 55. Dan Conley's 55, the district attorney.
So, Peter, not so long ago, I hate to bring up a sore subject, you wrote editorials for the paper ran, the Boston Phoenix. Give us a 30-second editorial that you would have written had the Phoenix still been around.
I would have said that there are two candidates that Phoenix voters should give serious thought to: John Conley, because of his commitment to changing the schools and his guts in fighting Tom Menino, and John Barros, who has been the most promising newcomer to hit the scenes in a long time.
And by the way, those happen to be the two that were also endorsed by the Boston
Globe.
Unfortunately,
Boston.
Yes. I think that could have been a reasonable Phoenix editorial.
The other one who's been a standout, who has gotten very little attention, is Bill Walczak very vocal stand against casinos. He's the only one who's really taken that kind of a position. It makes him a standout, but For some reason, same with Michael Ross, neither one of them has really caught on.
Well, you know, it's funny. Walczak, and he's a really smart guy. You can tell 5 minutes after you start talking
to
him.
And an accomplished guy.
And a very accomplished guy, that's right. You know, he gave the impression in a lot of these debates that he really didn't want to be there. He was kind of annoyed by the whole forum. He didn't have the right sort of expression on his face or something like that. And Michael Ross has got a lot of great innovative ideas for the city. You know, especially in the Herald NECN debate, he was too mild-mannered. He didn't seem like he had the fire in the belly. You know, it was not dominated
him. Walczak also has the disadvantage of coming from Dorchester, which is loaded for candidates. I mean, I went through Dorchester this weekend, where I grew up. I now live in Jamaica Plain, but I saw wall-to-wall Marty Walsh signs. I mean,
I've
never quite seen anything like that before.
Speaking of I hate to reference polling, and I've criticized people who have, so let me reference it right now. Each of the four polls that came out in the last 2 weeks had John Connolly atop. Everyone had him atop by 3-4 points. And then there were three people right behind, depending on the poll, Golar Ritchie, Walsh, and Dan Connolly. So forget those four for the second. Since you mentioned Walczak, and I think he finally has done what he should have done the whole campaign, is focus on the issue that separates him from everybody else, which is casinos. Who's the, I use the term advisedly, the second-tier candidate who could surprise people tomorrow?
Rob Consalvo.
And why is that?
His base, I think he's really got the Menino support as well.
Neighbor of Tom Menino's.
Yeah, exactly. A neighbor and, I think a friend and confidant. He might – I don't even know if there really is a Menino machine working out there. But if they are, I'd say they're probably working for him.
What do you think, Peter Kadzis?
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure if either Consalvo or Walsh could come in. I think Consalvo's problem is Consalvo's a problem for Connolly. Connolly and Consalvo draw on a lot of the same types of voters. They abut his neighbors. I don't know. I would still keep an eye on Golar Ritchie. Mm-hmm.
Talk about signs. I mean, when you drive through Mattapan and Roxbury, I mean, it's just – I've seen more Golar Ritchie than Barrows. You see a lot of Barrows, too, but you see tons of Golar Ritchie signs. So, you know, who knows? And some people think that because Golar Ritchie used to work for the mayor and that she may keep a lot of the mayor's people in place, that there's a silent group of Menino people that will be working on her behalf in terms of getting
possible.
Out the vote, too.
Well, I'll tell you this. I don't think there's a single – Menino person in City Hall working for John Connolly. I think they're
all. Well, we should say he's the only one, as people know, who challenged Menino when it was still thought that Tom Menino was going to be running for re-election. That's why you're saying that.
Yeah, exactly. I interviewed Menino right after John Connolly jumped into the race, before Menino had decided whether he was going to run.
How was that?
Oh, my God.
Oh, I remember that interview.
He was brutal on John Connolly.
Yeah.
But you know something?
Was that interview
calling
that
him a young,
that Menino
young
was
man.
Running,
yeah,
by
me
the way.
Too. I know.
You know, I know everybody loves Menino and everybody in the city has met Menino. But, I mean, why shouldn't someone challenge him after 20 years? Why shouldn't he let – I mean, Bill Walczak has been great about saying, Mayor Menino, please stop, you know, making the appointments to the BRA. Please let the next mayor have his imprint. And it's as if Tom Menino cannot let go.
Because people like living in Boston, they'd be run out if they did. Remember poor Sam Yoon, remember?
But listen.
That's right.
But literally left town.
No, he got run out of town. He couldn't get a job after he –
Becky Davis Mullen, she was run out of town as well.
Run out of town.
But listen, these appointments Menino is making, don't underestimate the power of a sitting mayor to co-opt people who are named. I'm not, by the way, I agree with Walczak. Walczak's 100% right. But still, I'm not that worked up about it.
Yeah.
Because the power of the mayor of Boston to co-opt all of these supposedly independent people is anonymous.
You know, speaking of power, this will make Marjorie happy, I'm sure. Marty Walsh, has a base on his own, a state rep. He's supposedly really good at constituent service, that sort of thing. If there was ever a test for organized labor in an election, it seems to me is this. Marjorie and I have discussed this a lot, which is if you have a one-on-one race and one candidate is organized, is endorsed by labor and he or she loses, to me that's not that big a deal. When you have a 12-candidate race, there is this divided. If organized labor can't bump Marty Walsh into the top 2 when you're probably going to need 15, 16, 17% to make it. It seems to me that is almost the death knell of organized labor's clout in political
you're
elections in the city.
Assuming they all live in Boston. I'm assuming they all lie about living in
Boston. Well, no, but a lot, a lot of them do.
But there's two things. Trade unions across the United States have been Marty Walsh's biggest contributors.
Building trades.
Building trades, yeah. In Boston, however, almost 40% of the public employees who contribute to campaigns have been contributing to Marty Walsh. So he's got the local money and he's got the national money.
Right, so I'm saying, so this is a major test for organized labor tomorrow.
You know what I wonder, though, too, because Walsh has been, he's one of the proponents of lifting the cap on charter schools, which is something, of course, the Boston Teachers Union doesn't like. I think there are 5,000 BTU
In Boston.
They endorsed Felix Arroyo, by the way.
They did. So I'm wondering...
And Consalvo.
I'm wondering how much
how much, will there be rank-and-file people that will be out for Walsh?
Listen, I know some Boston teachers that are voting for John Conley.
Yeah.
You know, there is a difference between the union leadership and the members.
Oh, Marjorie's smiling. You know, there was also someone who I would argue stepped on the huge story being the mayoral runoff tomorrow, but many would argue a bigger story was made, at least temporarily, at 10 o'clock this morning. Here's Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis at 10 o'clock this morning responding to criticisms that diversity within the department, the criticisms from organizations like the Mass Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, did not influence his decision to leave.
My command staff that I promote myself is 42% of people of color and diversity. I'm proud of that record. I'm proud of my transfers that I've made that are in the high 30% into the specialty units. Now, I'm also proud of the fact that the issues that were brought up when I first got here were brought to me by Mamlio. And I attempted really hard to work with that organization. And I think if you look at my record, you'll see that I did the things that they asked me to do.
Mamlio is the acronym for the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers.
You know, there's a lot. There's conflicting views on Ed Davis. My colleague Peter Galsunis wrote a pretty favorable column in the Boston Herald about him this morning. Oh, he did quote Jimmy Cornell of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association about Davis saying, "Don't let the door hit you on the way out." meaning Davis. On the other hand, Jeff Brown started the 10-point coalition. The Reverend Jeff Brown called him a class act. David Bernstein, one of our associates here, was critical about him in Boston Magazine. But personally, I think I always liked the guy. What do you think of Ed Davis?
Oh, yeah. No, this is a very, very classy guy. And unlike some people who come across with a very even demeanor, like somebody like John McCain, you know they're ready to blow it any minute. But, right? But not so.
Exactly,
it's so true.
Right.
But Ed Davis, you just know that calm and even demeanor is genuine and true. I mean, just think about some of the cases that he raised this morning. He was talking about that African-American Northeastern student who it took 3 years to solve her murder and how that was so important to him. And he said it was low-key. No one was thinking about it. We were thinking about it every day. I believe him, you know. It's like he wasn't just following the media in terms of the cases that were important to
Let
him.
Let me make 2 points about Ed Davis. One, the neighborhood I live in Jamaica Plain has had a number of shootings and murders in and around it. Every time I've gone out to one of these crime scenes,
he's there.
Ed Davis, not hovering over the officers. He's watching, and you can tell the cops know that he's watching.
Well, you know, Marjorie and I have been for years and years. Tina Cherry, who we both admire, the Louis D. Brown Peace Institute, as the Mother's Day March for Peace, where the families of people who've been murdered in and around Boston and other places come too. And you would think it's an audience that would not be very friendly to Ed Davis. He's been there every single year I've been there. So I don't think there's any question
you know
about his commitment.
Who else has been there every year I've been there?
Tom Menino.
No.
Who?
Well, Tom Menino, but
yeah.
Dan Colley, the attorney.
Yeah. Yes, but you know, but we shouldn't confuse the fact that I think we all agree he's a very caring, committed person. But I think it's fair to say there's some issues that I think this minority issue I've interviewed Larry Ellison a couple of times, the head of the minority law enforcement thing. And the reality is when there were promotions a month or two ago and the people of color had done exactly the same on the civil service test, all whites were promoted. I think one Latino, I'm not sure. And as soon as Mamlio screamed bloody murder, that day, Davis added two people of color to the list.
This is not why he's stepping down.
No, I'm not suggesting it is, but there's some clearance issues.
Yeah.
Amy Lord's killer not caught earlier? Hernandez, etc.
Listen, he announced today, I believe, this is my theory, because one, he wanted to get Mac. He's a master at managing his own image,
yeah.
as David Bernstein has written.
Yep.
Also, the subliminal message here is, okay, you people think you can do a better job with the police, you're
good
not going to have Ed Davis to kick around anymore.
I don't think it was either of those. I have to say, I think what it was he was worried, frankly, that two people would make the final tomorrow who were in the middle
that
on
makes
him.
Sense.
And then if he announces he's retiring after that happens, then it appears that he was forced out the door.
No, but listen, Emily's right. No. It's been out there for weeks that he was leaving.
I mean, I asked some of the candidates about this a week and a half ago. I said, he's not going to be around for your, you know, who are you going to name police commissioner? He's not going to be here.
It was a phony issue. What this is about, this is driving home the fact that Boston is undergoing regime change. You know, this is a big change. We had the superintendent of the schools leave before.
Yep.
She would have been attacked mercilessly in this campaign. Davis leaves with his Ed Davis leaves with his head high.
I
and he's going to Harvard, for God's sakes.
And he has, as he points out, 7 years. That is unheard of for a police commissioner.
It's a long time. And you know what he also did, too? He never, until the end, when after the marathon, when he was courted by the media all over the country for his work during the marathon, he never upstaged Tom Menino. Remember back when Bill Bratton was the commissioner of police?
Rudy Giuliani.
In Boston. Yeah. He didn't, he was a big publicity kind of guy, and Davis is not that kind of guy, at least until recently.
We're talking to Peter Kadzis and Emily Rooney about the mayor election. We're going to return to the mayoral issue in a couple of minutes when our colleague Hillary Sargent joins us, who's done this brilliant chart. She visited the homes of all 12 of the candidates who want to make the final. She'll join us in a few minutes, but I want to switch
gears. Tell
people
where they can find that before they...
Oh, I'm sorry. WGBHnews.org.
It's
Thank
great.
You very much
chart
for
girl.
Throwing
it's
that in.
It's a fantastic chart.
It is fantastic.
It is terrific.
We should move to Boston. Some of those houses look pretty good at a good price.
Good price. Well, we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But in the interim, here's a point counterpoint for you two. First, you're going to hear Republican Senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, talks about how government shutdown in the 90s was effective. Then you hear a fellow Republican, Congressman Peter King from New York, calling out Cruz for wasting time.
It is received wisdom in Washington that the 1995 government shutdown was a terrible loss for Republicans and we should never go there again. I don't believe the evidence supports that conclusion.
Ted Cruz is a fraud, and he'll no longer have any influence in the Republican Party.
Now, you said after this vote, you can start ignoring it. Do you think that's really true?
I hope so. I hope people get the message. This guy's bad for the party.
Peter King, a Republican, if it wasn't that's clear
great.
From New York, calls Ted Cruz, a Republican from Texas, a total fraud. Can we have a show of hands? Does anybody think government's going to shut down a week from today?
No,
anybody?
No.
No, it's not. So let's talk about the underlying issue, which is Obamacare. Marjorie,
by the way, I'm not so sure about
that. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's 50-50, I think. 50-50.
But even the overwhelmingly Republicans, including John Boehner until a few days ago, even John Boehner was railing against the shutdown, and all of a sudden the Tea Party Republicans in the House sort of captured him. But when Ted Cruz loses in the Senate, there's no real constituency for this, is there?
No, there is no constituency. But Cruz and the Tea Party, Cruz is not like a figure from American politics. He's more like Lenin. He's a dedicated revolutionary. He's a right-wing revolutionary. Guys like Cruz are far more radical than anyone ever elected from the left. And I think we underestimate them. I mean, I really do.
But he is a fraud. And by the way,
I agree.
The 1995 shutdown was also a fraud because, well, while it moved things, every single dollar that the government saved, everybody got their back pay. I mean, everybody thought, people went for 10 days. Nobody missed a day's pay. How did that, you know, square with saving nothing?
Well,
didn't make a bit of difference.
The bigger issue to me, though, and I do not understand this, we have the whole thing, the Republicans, they want to defund Obamacare, at least a lot of them do, and the nation is not exactly sold on Obamacare either. Where the heck is the president selling this thing? People are supposed to enroll by October 1st. They've got, like, Jennifer Hudson and Jason, how do you pronounce his name, Derulo, out tweeting about this and pastors preaching about it, getting people to go sign up. But I still don't understand.
I don't either.
What it's going to be, what we need to do. Is it good? Is it
maybe
bad?
Maybe it isn't any good. I have no idea.
Well, listen.
But people are blaming already. I had somebody show me their bill the other day. Thanks to Obamacare. I'm going, what?
You don't have Obamacare.
What are you talking about?
Listen, the polls also show that while there's a lot of suspicion about Obamacare, Americans overwhelmingly are opposed to efforts to defund it.
Right.
The way I reconcile those two things is I think there's a wait-and-see attitude about it. And I'll tell you this, I think the Republicans' big fear is that Obamacare might work, and that would be
But how about answering Marjorie's question?
It's such a personal thing. Where is the president?
I agree. He's out to lunch.
Out to lunch, I guess so. How can you not know? He should be in lunch.
You know, Marjorie and I used
so
to,
great.
Well, about a year ago in our former radio life, Marjorie, I opened the phone lines one day, and we said that only people who were big supporters of Obamacare could call, and we invited them to tell us what it is that they liked. A couple of people who had kids who were between 21 and 26 said, I can keep my kid
That's
on the
me.
Plan till 26. Someone said something about pre-existing conditions, and these were all Obamacare advocates. Nobody had any idea. They supported the concept. They love universal health care. You know what the big mistake the president made on this, in my estimation, to begin with, other than the fact that he has sold it so poorly? In tough economic times, the vast majority of people don't care very much about covering those who are not covered. And that's all he ever talks about. The issue should not be how you're going to get the 10% who don't have any health insurance covered. The issue is how can you make it more affordable for the 90% of us who do have health coverage, some of whom can't even afford to use it because of the copays and deductibles. I literally cannot think of one moment where the president or one of his people has explained clearly and coherently how it's going to benefit real people, except for some rhetoric.
I don't get it. I mean, they're supposedly
They don't understand.
I'm only half kidding.
But you could. Yeah. I mean, that people have to enroll.
I know nothing.
It's true. I do know this. People have
I got
to
nervous
enroll.
When you said we were going to talk about it today.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. Well, I don't know whether it's a disaster or not.
October 1st is a few days away, right? That's when people have to enroll for these exchanges.
I can't believe that.
Yeah, well, there you go. Your daughter's 30. You have to enroll for Obamacare. So, that's only a few days
away. But the employer mandate was postponed for a year, by the way, which is another issue that is getting very little attention.
We've talked about this so many times before, that one of the chief causes of bankruptcy in the United States of America is medical bills by people who have insurance.
No, it is the number one cause of personal bankruptcy. Yeah. People's health bills, again, as you say,
who have insurance. So why can't he talk about that? I mean, I know people personally whose parents have racked up all these bills because they've had open heart surgery and all this kind of stuff, and the insurance company shuts them off. I mean, it's crazy. Why doesn't he talk about this? Why don't you call him, Jim?
Well, he and I have not spoken that much lately, and so I had a feeling that I won't
say
have...
Jim Browdy on the line.
And you know what the other thing is? Before we return to the most important issue is where do the 12 candidates for mayor in Boston live? The other thing that is amazing to me about the attention span of both the American people and our elected leaders, how much have we heard about Syria in the last 2 weeks? I mean, we were this close to bomb. You have? Where have you heard that?
I feel like I have.
I've heard virtually nothing. Mm. It's a pretty important deal.
You haven't been going to those seminars at night with me.
I've been going to the Obamacare seminar.
This is the United States of amnesia.
Well, it really is. Okay, we're joined in the studio. We have Peter Katzis here and Emily Rooney, but we're joined by Hillary Sargent, a.k.a. Chart Girl. She has a chart at WGBHnews.org of where the mayoral wannabes live, with photographs, with commentary. Hello there,
it's
Hillary.
Hi, Jim.
It's a great chart.
It is, it's great. Thank
you. Okay, so the first question is, who's got the best house?
I would say Walzak has the best house. House, best location, great street. Friendly neighbors.
Also got the most money.
Lots of Walzak signs.
I actually like Dan Conway's house better.
Yeah, it's a very busy street, though.
Yeah.
You know, in West Roxbury, you got to be careful. After school, you can get mowed down.
Though. I've been on that. It's
a
wide
street. What's the name of the street that Conley lives on? I'm going to drive by this afternoon and check it out.
He lives on Corey Street.
Oh, Corey Street. Oh, I know Corey Street.
Yeah, right near the intersection of Wells.
His shutters need the paint.
His shutters could use a little bit of paint, but great landscaping. Really.
So give us a few highlights for you personally. While you characterize all 12, give us three or four that stuck with you, the good, the bad, the ugly.
I thought Charlotte Goler Ritchie's house was interesting just in the sense that you almost can't see it, and it sits right next to a really scary house that appears to be haunted.
Oh, no.
Does she need to take some of those trees down? Too many trees?
A little overgrown.
Well, if she wants her house to be photographed better the next time around, I would say she definitely does. I would say a lot of chain link fences, which I think is an interesting. I think once you get elected mayor, you put up a real fence so that people can't, you know, peer in.
That's very ugly.
But you said that spoke to transparency was one of your points, which I think is a very good point. As ugly and rusted as they may be,
Mike Ross didn't have more greenery. You pointed that out.
Just one little plant.
And it's not a very pretty house. I mean, for a guy that's so well-dressed and looks impeccable all the time.
Single guys, you know.
Yeah, maybe that's
it. I will say this. I lived in two doors down from where Mike Ross currently lives about 5 years ago in the identical house. There are three of them.
Oh.
So it has an amazing walk-in closet on the third floor. It's gorgeous granite kitchens. It's a pretty nice house.
Walk-in closet. That's where he keeps all those nice clothes.
Is it aluminum siding on the outside? It can't possibly be.
I don't know. That's a good question.
I can't imagine Mike Ross and aluminum siding. Just seems like very
Hey, Hillary Sargent, the other significant thing about Mike Ross, you did a comparison. This is not on the chart, but it's subsequent research about lawn signs for candidates in their own neighborhood and their own street. And I was stunned by what you reported about Ross.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things to point out is there are people who have lived in these neighborhoods for a long time. I think Mike Ross bought that property pretty recently. So to his credit, he hasn't been there long enough to make friends with the neighbors. I also think that's an area that...
But essentially, there are no signs on a street. Ross signs is what you're saying.
There aren't a ton of them. I didn't spot more than the one on his house. But that's also an area where...
that's not a ton. I think that's a fair description. What's that?
But it's an area where students live. It's Mission Hill. Whereas Walzak, I mean, I think he's lived in that house for a long time. Charlotte Guler Ritchie has lived in that house for more than 25 years. She didn't have a ton of signs around her house, which I thought was interesting.
Because she's hiding. No one knows she's in there.
That's right.
So there's a disturbing detail that you noted on John Barrow's house. And I saw the picture of John Barrow's house. And it
disturbing
was
disturbing might be pushing it.
Well, I didn't know if John thought this was the way to go with the bricks or if the previous owner thought it was the way to go with the bricks. But tell us about the bricks.
Well, if you tilt your head 45 degrees to one side, they appear to be straight, but they're sort of dizzying beyond that.
It's a design, but it doesn't really work. It's like an
art
deco.
I don't get the sense that he did that.
It's a deco thing, but it doesn't work.
Yeah. You know what's heartening about this? By the way, we're talking to Hillary Sargent, whose brilliant chart with photographs and commentary. I mean it. Everybody loves it. Of all 12 mayoral residences, this is at WGBHnews.org. She's also known as Chart Girl. You know what's most heartening to me? The range, according to you, of assessed values, with the exception of David James Wyatt, who we can mention in a minute, the high end was Dan Conley, highest assessed $444,000, and the lowest assessed value was $264,000, which was Charles Clemens. I mean, sort of ultimately the ultimate sort of middle class.
Yeah. Dan Connolly is the Bloomberg of this group.
Yeah.
Right.
But that is.
No, I think there's no, you know, there's no rich guy from the Back Bay who wants to be mayor. And I think that's good and interesting.
How about David James Wyatt? You don't have an assessed David value James of this Wyatt, on this thing.
The address that we were given for David James Wyatt is Academy Homes 1, which I believe is a subsidized housing development that's owned in some way by the city or by some kind of collective. So there is no assessed value for his unit specifically.
How are the signs? How are his signs on his street?
I had a little trouble finding his address, and I asked some neighbors who didn't know who he was or that he was running for mayor or how to find his address very easily. So.
Well, they're representative of the city at large.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right.
You know what I think you can gather from looking at all these houses? You know, just if we were all going to go into the real estate business, porches are key. You know, the porches.
Cute.
I mean, Walzak's got
a great porch.
The DA, Conley's got a great porch. Charles Yancey's got a fantastic porch at his house in Dorchester. John Conley, the front runner, has no porch.
Well, he has a big yard,
kind of an ugly house, if I do say so myself. Very ugly.
Very ugly.
Wouldn't you say?
Well, I think it's sort of in keeping with his theme.
It's what I call a garage house.
The what?
A garage house.
A garage house when the garage is the most prominent thing about the house.
My guess is he's choosing neighborhood and family over the looks of his house because that's a great neighborhood. And that's sort of him, right? He's not the most handsome of all the candidates. He's got sort of your basic haircut. You know, he's got a basic house.
Who is the most handsome of all the candidates?
I knew that, by the way. Sorry.
Are we leaving out Mike Ross from the calculation?
It's
Barros.
Barros is pretty good looking.
Oh, I have a great pointer on Barros. There's an abandoned lot right across the street. So if he's elected, I was thinking someone could easily buy that and build a house and live right across the street from the mayor.
It's a brilliant
and
idea.
And their snow will always be plowed.
Yes.
Very first.
Hey, you have a cop in front of your house at all times.
As I said, you did an addendum, at least for us, about lawn signs, anecdotally. Peter, let me ask you, there's a great difference of opinions. First of all, the tiredest line in politics, other than the only poll that counts is the one on election day, is lawn signs don't vote. But lawn signs sometimes do vote. What's your, it's particularly in a city election, what's your sense of the significance of large numbers of lawn signs? Lawn signs have any correlation to votes or no?
I don't know whether there's a correlation, but it's part of the political culture. I mean, I think they have some vague effect. I mean, for example, in Dorchester, where you see all these Mardi Wall signs,
amazing.
I think it's subliminally difficult to resist the allure.
Well, also makes the statement subliminally. It's exactly what I was going to say. Hey, this guy's a winner. Whether he is or not, I want to be with a winner. And I think it does have that sort of...
What do you think about direct mail? Because we've gotten a ton of that in the Back Bay. I don't know about you, Peter, but...
No, we've gotten a lot of direct mail.
I think Marty Walsh seems it's a little over papering in terms of what I've seen. I mean, almost a little desperate and environmentally just stacks of pamphlets on every front porch every day.
Hey, I hate the robocalls.
Oh, I get 15 of those a day now.
Yeah. Who'd you get? Anybody famous in a robocall? No, I mean, there are some
Gloria Steinem.
You did, really?
I got
who's endorsed Gullah Ritchie.
Gullah Ritchie, right.
Yeah.
I got a real person, and they knew who I was.
Is that so?
they said, Emily?
Are they fans or not?
That was a Marty Walsh call.
Hey, Hillary Sargent, since there are three Boston voters in here, Marjorie and I are not, sadly, even though it was... What was your point before that if you're really interested in the race and you happen not to live here, you should be able to vote anyway?
Exactly.
Was that your point?
Absolutely.
And Marjorie and I are really interested, even though we live in Brookline and Cambridge.
Down?
I am actually not technically a Boston voter yet.
Oh, you're not?
I just moved back.
Oh, you just moved back to Boston?
But my mother, who is very much a Boston voter, told me yesterday that she plans to vote for Michelle Wu for mayor.
Well, she's early by 4 years.
Yeah.
That's
all.
What is she? She's running for an at-large.
And she actually keeps pretty good tabs on things. So if that's indicative of where the electorate stands, I think this is sort of just a free-for-all.
I think it is indicative.
You know, on that note, by the way, before we wrap this up, Peter, no one knows more about city politics, in my estimation, than you do. You're in a small coven of three or four people know everything. How many candidates? There are 19 for at-large city council. Yeah. How many of the 19 can you name?
Oh, I can't name. I know who I'm voting for at large.
But how many of the other 18 can you name?
Very few. I know the four I'm voting for.
That's really... that's part of why you're looking
at me
like
that.
I'm glad you didn't ask me that question.
I selected early.
Yeah. So, okay, you can't name the 19 and you have no idea what Obamacare does.
No,
is that correct, Emily?
I know who I'm voting for.
Okay, so what's the... if you could put a ribbon on your 12 houses, what's the moral of the 12 house, the dozen house story, Hillary Sargent? What's the takeaway from there?
I think in a race where it's hard to keep track of all of their names, I mean, for me, I spent 4.5 hours on Friday driving around to all these houses, and I feel like I have a much better image to go with each candidate after seeing their houses than I do after reading profiles or seeing a photo. I mean, and I think that's helpful in a race like this to have something like that, just to picture in your head. When I close my eyes and picture Barros, I no longer picture his, enormous billboard-sized lawn signs. I now picture his, crazy bricks on his front porch.
You know what I tried to do? Look at your chart and think if I could have matched.
Oh, that is
the person.
Brilliant.
And I
that
couldn't
is brilliant.
Have done
it. No, it's tricky.
I couldn't have done it.
So we should do, talk to the election commission about the next mayoral election. Instead of having the names, just having the photographs of the
houses.
And you pick the houses. I think pets would be great, too.
Well,
but that's trickier.
When Nally Jacobson always did the At Home with the Governor pieces. Yeah.
The one that did John Silver in 1990.
But I always love those. You go to see the kitchen. Yeah. And I remember that
she
went...
We've been doing those with all the candidates. You just didn't notice it.
Oh, I'm
recently.
Sorry. Did you do the at home?
We did the at homes with all the governors.
Marjorie's humiliated.
Blah, blah, blah.
I am humiliated because I remember the one where Bill Weld said that they wrote some of their traditions were writing nasty doggerel to each other on Christmas Eve. Remember
that worked. That marriage
really
worked out real well.
Okay, so Emily Rooney, Peter Kadzis, Hillary
we'll
Sargent.
See after we vote.
All three of you, thank you so much. Great chart again. WGBHnews.org to find the chart of the 12 houses.
Okay, Peter Kadzis is WGBH contributor. Emily Rooney, catch your weeknights at 7 o'clock in Greater Boston. And Hillary Sargent, a.k.a. Chart Girl, has a great chart of all the mayor's houses. You can see it at WGBHnews.org. Last night, of course, with the Emmys, and a good chunk of the shows that were nominated are on cable TV, shows that a lot of people can't afford to watch. But would you watch them for free if it meant watching and interacting with commercials? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This mayor's race, it's complicated and complex.
WGBH News political contributor Peter Katsas.
I'm really, really impressed with the goodwill and high quality of the candidates that are running. But looking ahead, we have to get them to be specific, to talk about what they really want to change.
Get to know all the Boston mayoral candidates online at WGBHnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and AAA Southern New England, helping and serving members for more than 110 years with roadside assistance, insurance and financial products, and a full-service travel agency. Details at AAA.com. AAA, membership for life. And Roger Williams University, presenting oceanographer Sylvia Earle on September 25th as part of the President's Distinguished Speaker Series. You can find more information at rwu.edu. That's rwu.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Ginn. You know, one of the great television ironies is that as much as people cannot stand advertising on TV, a show about advertising, meaning Mad Men, is hugely popular. So, would you watch commercials if it meant you could watch cable shows, movies, listen to music for free in return? We want to get your thoughts in a minute, 877-301-8970. But first, in studio to talk about a local company that's aiming to change the way people watch commercials is our colleague and reporter, Christina Quinn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there.
Hi, Christina.
Hello.
So I heard your great story coming in this morning in the car. Tell people about it. But also, it's not just any old commercials you have to listen to. It's commercials that would be kind of targeted especially to me or to you or to Jim. So tell people what the deal is.
Absolutely. So you're watching ads that are targeted to your specific demographic. So the company's called HitBliss,
yep.
And they're based in Lexington. And the whole idea is that, okay, so they have two separate things. So there's HitBliss, the store, so you can like go on and just, you know, use your credit card to rent movies and what have you. But then there's a HitBliss Earn app. That's EARN. And so you download the app, and onto your computer you enter information about yourself, and it's completely in your control. So you enter your age, gender, what have you. But the more information you give, like your annual income, how many kids you have, even your browsing history, the more specific targeted ads you'll get. And then that way you actually earn money. So you watch these ads. They're targeted to you. And you interact with them, and then you start to like rack up the
yeah. But
cash.
What happens if it turns out I mean, the great deal is, it seems to me, because I have no interest in watching ads at all, is the great deal until I heard your report this morning was, well, you sign up for this thing, you don't watch the ads, you turn down the sound, and you wait till the ads are over. You've earned all this credit, and then you can buy movies and music, but it doesn't work that way,
it
right?
It doesn't work that way. You are forced to engage with these ads. Which kind of sounds like a nightmare to
a lot
of people.
Well, how do they do that? How do they do that?
So, there's an algorithm. It's an app. So there's lots of science and math behind it that I can't explain. They probably wouldn't even tell me because it's proprietary. But there's this app, and so what happens is that so this thing, the ad starts playing, right? And then this face will pop up and says, "Are you paying attention?" And so if you don't click on the face, the happy face starts to turn into this angry face, and then the ad pauses and says you didn't earn any points for watching this
what
ad.
What if I just turn the volume down?
No, the same thing will happen. The ad will pause and it'll say, "Hey, you're not listening to, like, how can you pay attention if you're not listening to the ad?" So again, the ad pauses, you're not getting points for watching the ad. So it's forcing you to actually like engage with this advertisement, and you know
what I thought was brilliant about this though? You have a new baby.
I do.
So if they're going to target the ads toward you, they might be advertising all these really cool, neat baby products that maybe you didn't know about, or you know, ads for some other thing you should be doing to turn your kid into a Mozart or whatever it is. So I could see where that would be really appealing. Whereas if you were, you know, 16, it would be different sorts of ads. If you're 80, it would be different kinds of ads. I can see where targeting ads, to me, would have a certain appeal.
Right. Well, that's the point behind the model. So Sharon Pyer co-founded the company with her husband, Andrew Prohodko, and their whole argument is that people like advertising if it's relevant to them.
Exactly.
So, you know, she was saying, like, you know, back in when TV first came out, there were Tide commercials, there were soap operas, you know, and that's why people were like, oh, I like these commercials because I'm learning about, you know, all these kinds of soaps that I can use and for whatever. But, yeah, so that's what they're saying, that people actually like ads. So look at the Super Bowl,
so would
right?
So would you do this?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was
this
so skeptical.
This is Christina Quinn with whom we're speaking. Would you do this?
I was skeptical at first. I was like, come on. I'm never going to watch these commercials. Like, that's. But then I actually tried it out, and I saw how it was very easy. It was really easy to do it. And then all of a sudden, I had enough money to rent a $4 movie.
For nothing, because essentially, what do they give you, 25 cents an ad or that kind of thing?
Yeah, so you can earn up to 25 cents to watch an ad.
877-301-8970. I'd rather be waterboarded than do this. Let me be clear.
Not
if they're paying you, if you accrue a credit of 25 cents an ad, and you apparently, according to Christina, you actually have to pay attention or else you'll get caught because of the technology here. Is it worth it to you to accrue this credit? You get free movies, you get free music if you choose. Essentially, the more time you're willing to spend watching advertising that is targeted to you, it's not just general advertising you'd have no interest in, is that trade-off worth it to you? What's the answer for you?
I think in certain circumstances, it is. Like if you just have a new baby and you're broke because you're paying for childcare and you want to find out about the latest.
You mean if you can't afford? If you can't, otherwise can't afford? Well, I agree
with
that.
You just bought a new condo or you bought a new house and you're up to your eye teeth and your mortgage payments. You think, this is a way to maybe spend. I mean, people order movies from Netflix or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a way to spend like $15 a week or something like that. But I think the idea of them being targeted, if you don't mind the privacy sacrifice, which obviously if you're going to tell them how much money you make and all that kind of stuff, but things that I might want to know about that I don't know about, I find sort of appealing.
Well, it's funny you mention the privacy thing because the app lives on your computer. So they've told me that there is no access to your private information. They serve as a matchmaker between you and the advertiser's criteria.
Yeah.
So the advertiser actually doesn't know that you, Marjorie Egan, that you are making such and such amount of money and that you have, you know, so many kids at home, like that you are this person. Like they don't know you. Like, so as, you know, like right now, if you're browsing, you have all of these, you know, you have cookies being, you know, the cookies enable you to enable, what have you, marketers to find you and
right.
to target you. But this is different in that it's a matchmaker between the advertiser and your criteria.
Right,
so.
And the NSA is not reading your email either. 877-301-8970. You know, mechanically, 25 cents. Well, it doesn't sound like much to me. I have to watch 16 ads to ultimately see a movie. It sounds to me like 25 cents for an advertiser is a huge amount of money. The good news is Marjorie Egan is interested in X, so I'm going to give her an ad about X.
Right.
The bad news is, what's the likelihood that the generic Marjorie Egan is going to buy something? 25 cents, buy that thing. 25 cents is a huge amount of money, no?
It is a lot of money, and that's sort of what the other side of the argument is. You know, I spoke with Dan Rayburn, who is this expert on streaming media, and he's saying that, like advertisers will pay $25 for 1,000 clicks for an online ad. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this would completely reverse that around. It's basically $2,500 for the same amount for 100 people, right? If that's correct math. For 1,000 clicks. So that's a lot of money. And he's saying like people won't be able to afford this.
But on the other hand, who watches ads anymore? I mean, even if you're watching live television, as soon as the ad comes on, you get up and you go to the bathroom, you go get a glass of water, whatever you're going to do, or you put the kid to bed. I mean, everybody's DVRing everything now, and you kind of fly right through all the
ads. Well, let me give you, I was going to say that next. The most I ever watch an episode of Breaking Bad, which I DVR is maybe 20 or 30 times is the most I'd see an individual. And what I do every single time,
yeah,
including the first time, when you record it, is you speed through, you fast forward through the ads, and you always go a couple of seconds over, and you have to rewind. My sense is, and I know nothing about business, but I assume these people do, but the notion that this is going to catch on with people other than those who really just don't have the money to do a movie or whatever.
That's a lot of people.
I understand, but they're pretty busy too, and this takes a lot of time. What do you guys think? 877-301-8970. Would you sit through a bunch of targeted ads in return for which, let's assume it's 25 cents and a movie costs $5. That means you have to sit through 20 ads. 20 ads at 25 cents each to accrue $5 a credit. You're going to sit through 25 ads to see a movie?
How long are they? They're a minute long.
No, they're pretty long. Like the ads that I watched were longer. So I watched, you know, it was funny because I did the math and I was like, wait a minute, I'm getting paid more to watch these ads. So I watched probably about five or six ads, and within that time, I earned
6 minutes of a movie.
No, I earned $3.99, which was enough to rent a movie from their store. I think it was I think I was going to rent Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh,
so they
one
have
of the great movies of the last couple
it.
Of years.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay,
it's
let's
not
take
great,
some calls.
But it's pretty good.
It is fabulous.
It's not fabulous.
All the acting is brilliant. The movie is terrific.
Okay.
And it's also my home team, the Philadelphia Eagles.
877-301-8970.
Jennifer Lawrence is brilliant. De Niro's brilliant. They're all brilliant. Let's go to Jay and in Marshfield. You're on Boston Public Radio with Christina Quinn, me and Marjorie. Hey, Jay.
Hi. My comment is I think we're already paying for the privilege of watching ads. You know, we get a cable bill every month, and And yet there seems to be more and more ads all the time. When cable first came out down in Plymouth, there were a lot of stations that seemed to be without ads. And I thought it was perfect. You know, you pay for it and you get to watch it.
You mean that was the original notion behind cable, is that not only would the quality be high, but that it'd be advertising free?
Yeah, I think advertising is very intrusive in our lives. I'd be interested to try and figure out what effect it has on young kids.
Well, we know what effect it has on young
kids. All
it forces
Cheerios,
them to buy horrible
right. covered with chocolate for breakfast.
Hey, Jay, thank you for your call. You know, just reminded me. What's the name of
Congressman
Capuano's bill? We are watching you.
Oh, yeah, we are watching
this
you.
Bill where it turns out there's some technology for which a patent has been filed, which allows your cable box to watch you, literally watch you while you're watching television so that they can target ads to you. And he's filing a bill that wouldn't preclude that. But if the thing was turned on your screen, it would say the words "we are watching you."
Joe from Boston, what do you think about getting paid to watch ads in return for free stuff?
Hello, friends. How are you?
Great.
Okay, so my idea is really a solution for the illegal immigration problem here is we can co-opt a room full of immigrants to interact with these TVs and then just take a small percentage of their of their hard work.
You're like a Steve Jobs. Let me tell you, you're as entrepreneurial as they get. But by the way, you know, you could hire people. That's a brilliant idea. You hire people. For the 25 cents, you give them 10, which is essentially what Joe's suggesting. And then
that's way too much. That's
Joe, you cheapskate, you.
Joe, you're my kind of guy. Thank you for the call. Are they doing, Christine, in your report, you said something about iPhones, droids, all that sort of stuff. What are they doing there?
Right. So the whole point behind this also is to empower the user. So you watch commercials in your own time. So they have an app that came out, their Android app came out very recently, and they're rolling out their iPhone app soon. So this means when you're standing at the bus stop or even on the train, you can watch these ads. And so when you get home, you don't have to deal with them. Like the money will be in your account and you can just, you know, buy or rent whatever you want.
Or Marjorie, if we have a guest, if we have a slow segment during the show, one of us can ask the questions and you can just watch some ads.
Watch the ads. That's right. What kind of ads have you gotten? When you did your ad watching thing,
right.
Was it ads that were targeted to you, Christina, or were they just generic ads?
Well, I think – so they're still in beta, so I think they have a limited number of marketers with them right now.
Okay.
But I – based on what they told me, they had to keep some stuff proprietary. But what I got was I got the Aflac ad. I got Aflac, I got Dr. Pepper, and Liberty Mutual. And they were all really funny, clever commercials.
So you said to get the Aflac ad, what did you – on your little form, did you say, I love geese? I mean, what did you say?
That's exactly what I said. I think that's a duck, though.
It is a duck. Whatever it is. But obviously they're thinking because you're a young mother – I assume the theory is a young mother, you need insurance.
Right. Yeah, things happen. So I think that was probably one of them. And then the other thing, the Dr. Pepper, well, they were like hip ads, and obviously I'm very hip.
Very.
So that's why it applied to me. But they were really catchy. And that's the thing. And then because of this, I mean, because of the app, like you really have to engage with it.
Are they different ads than you'd see for Dr. Pepper on a regular station?
Yeah, one of them looked familiar. One of them I think I'd seen on TV before, but the others I had never seen before.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you have your own special ads, Jim.
Doesn't do it. Literally, it's not. I'm sorry. It's a local company. I want them to do well, but we have spent the last couple of decades of our lives, Marjorie, avoiding advertising on television. This first caller was right also. That's one of the reasons why cable was so hot to begin with. The notion that we'd be drawn back in. Again, if there's financial need, I totally get it. It's a great deal. Short of that,
one of the great things about the station. Correct?
What's that?
No ads.
I am one of the reasons we're happy to
have
be here. One of
have
many.
Have you noticed that, Jim?
I did. Thomas from Dartmouth, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Thomas.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
You know, I'm that rare bird who probably hasn't seen a commercial in 2 years. I got the Roku system set up 2 years ago, and I literally have not seen a commercial except for one visit to my parents' house. When a commercial came on, I just found it so obnoxious and irritating. And, you know, I think that I've sort of been trained now after living off of the Netflix and Amazon and whatnot, and I will never go back to watching commercials. I'm happy to pay to not watch them, and I really think that's the future. I think the format of the commercial is a dying breed. And I think, you know, that the future of advertising is getting away from that format.
Thomas, what's the system you've set up? The what system?
Roku. The Roku.
Yeah, well, Roku,
explain
yeah.
that to people that don't know, because I don't.
I think the Apple version is probably more popular, from what I understand. But basically, it's just getting television through your internet connection.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, they're free channels. You can use it for absolutely for free. I pay $6 or whatever for Netflix to stream everything through my TV. And you know, I end up paying around $10 a month. Sometimes I'll stream, you know, the latest Mad Men episode or Breaking Bad. But usually, I just use the Netflix, and I can pause and.
And you're not, Thomas, a lot of people are doing the Netflix route like you are. Do you not subscribe to cable?
I do not subscribe.
Yeah, a lot of people are doing that to save money, and through the back door they're getting all these other things. Thomas, thank you for the call. You know what's an interesting test? I don't think you did this for your piece, Christina. The only example I could think of this prior when I heard about your story this morning before I listened to it was the Kindle. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you can pay X dollars, I think it's like $80, if you're willing to have a Kindle that every time you turn it on shows you ads. Mm-hmm. And you can buy a Kindle for, I don't know what the amount is, $120, $110, which is ad-free. I'd love to know what percentage of people decide to ante up the additional 30. But you have to go do a newscast.
Yeah, Christina has to go do the news. She has to go do the news. She has to listen to a few ads before she goes, too.
No, she doesn't, actually. That's the beauty. Hey, Christina Quinn, thank you. We're not done with you guys yet, but Christina, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a great story. But we're still taking calls here, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. But the guy that called previously, because I'm sort of a Luddite about these kinds of things, the guy that called previously is not able to watch regular shows, like TV shows.
Oh, yes. But a huge – I've told you
the
this
news?
Before.
You
Apple
can watch
TV.
The news?
No, not on the same day that it's happening. But a lot of it you can. A lot of it – by the way, you can – virtually every news show is online. You don't need one of these things.
I know, but that's – it's like a big production to me. You want to turn on the
it's
TV
not a
and
big,
watch
no,
the news.
No, it is not a big production once you've done it. Rachel,
well,
you're in Providence.
Why don't you come over and set it up for
Rachel,
me,
Rachel, you're in Providence. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey there, Rachel.
Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I'm actually a lot like the previous caller. We don't subscribe to cable. We have rabbit ears, which people ask.
You have rabbit ears?
I have rabbit ears, and we did that, actually. We did, when we had our first child, we didn't own a TV because we had just moved, and we said, well, let's see what happens if we don't have a TV for a while. And we lasted a long time until the first, like, big winter storm, and I was like, I want to see the news. And so my husband got us rabbit ears, and we can watch, you know, NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, and PBS. So we did that, and then we got an Apple TV to stream Netflix. And so that's all we have. And, you know, when we have two kids now, and, you know, there's a lot of anxiety, at least in the circle of moms that I have, about, like, content of TV and how much TV. And the only rule I have in my house, actually, now, and it's a rule I hope I never break, is not so much around content of children's programming. I just, no ads. Ever.
Good for you.
I try to keep advertising away from my kids more than anything else, sugary drinks, whatever. I'm pretty lax about a lot of stuff, but my kids are 4 and 2 now, and I have to say, as you know, my kids are in preschool, and I sort of see there's a very distinct difference, I think, between kids who get exposed to a lot of hyper manipulative, very targeted advertising for adults and for kids. And I, as much as this system sounds cool, I'd love to save more money, but I am happy to pay $8 a month Netflix and curate every aspect of my TV and never, my kids have almost, I mean, I don't know if they've ever really seen it. I don't even think they really know what ads are.
Rachel, but Rachel, your parenting sounds great. Don't you think you're depriving your 4-year-old, though, if he or she can't see Grand Theft Auto 5 ads every 30 seconds?
I know.
I'm so with you.
I really have to rethink it, but.
Hey, Rachel, you're totally right. Thanks for the call. Let's go take one more. Oops, quick one. My screen just went black.
Steven said he's very depressed because he was targeted by this company. He wound up with ads for Life Service Alert, a scooter, and arthritis medications.
Mimensi watched 60
I'm sorry,
Minutes.
Steven.
Let's go to Patricia in Rumford, Rhode Island. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Patricia.
Hi, I love your program. I hate to go anywhere when you're on because I might miss you.
Oh, we love that.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Patricia.
But my favorite advertisement has nothing to do with me at all, doesn't target me or anything, but it was for a pickup truck, and the man is going out in the freezing rain to save the little calf that's shivering and cold.
Oh.
And oh, and I don't need a pick. I'll never have a pickup truck, and I don't have a farm, and I don't have a cow, so it doesn't apply to me. But it was. I never mind. I wanted the man. But I mean,
you know, Patricia, you made the best point of them all. Is the ads that I like the most too? I'm thinking as you're speaking. Are ones that I'd have no interest. I don't buy. I mean, I have a great car. I love my car. I've had it for years. Some of the car ads are great. Some of the computer ads are great. My computer's fine. That was a brilliant point, Patricia, which sort of runs afoul of the basic notion that you type in all your attributes and you get what you theoretically want when you don't. Patricia, thanks for the call.
Thank you. It's my fear I'm missing out on some great thing that everybody knows about but me, and I feel like if I could
okay,
have these
Marjorie,
targeted
here's,
ads.
It's truth time. Mm-hmm. You bought a beautiful television several years ago.
I did.
And how many years was it before you realized? You said to me one day, I really think I should get HD. And I paused for a second. Why did I pause, Marjorie?
Because I had HD.
You had HD, and you just didn't know it for a few years. So I would suggest next time we have one of these discussions, you might want to recuse yourself.
Some of us are a little slower on the uptake.
No, I know, but you got it now,
Jim?
And you love it, right?
If I could figure out how to do that Netflix thing, I'd be doing it in 2 seconds. But I bought it. And now I don't know how to use it is the problem. And then you got to get it from
simple.
The computer to the television.
Okay,
I don't know how to do that.
Thank you.
So I'm going to hire someone to come over and get me organized. Anyway, Christina Quinn that just spoke with us is a reporter and on-air host with WGBH. When we come back, we're going to be joined, as we are every Monday at 1 o'clock, by the Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. He's going to talk about the Pope. He's going to talk about a Boston Strong license plate. And, of course, what's happening with Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Researchers at UMass Medical School in Worcester announced they'd found a way to shut down the extra chromosome that causes the developmental problems of people with Down syndrome.
Higher education impacts everything from our economy to our ability to remain a world leader.
We were fortunate to get funding for high-risk, high-impact work.
Listen for reports from WGBH's Higher Education Desk on campus with reporter Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Boston Children's Hospital. With suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close at hand. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well. And Fuller Craft Museum, with a reception celebrating two exhibitions, Art of Mosaics and Reversible Reactions, Art Meets Science at the MIT Glass Lab, Sunday, September 29th at 2 p.m., fullercraft.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It's 1 o'clock on Monday, which means it's open mic time. And since it is Monday, and he joins us every week at that time, he is the Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. Reverend Rivers, good to see you.
It does sound
very
distinguished.
Well, actually, Reverend Eugene Franklin Rivers III sounds even more distinguished.
But that sounds like Henry Louis Gates. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, fine. Gene Rivers, good to see you.
Well, greetings, people. How y'all doing?
Then you arrive, and I don't know how distinguished you actually sound. I'm not really sure, Gene Rivers.
That's okay. Look, I'll take that from a white woman.
No, it's okay. I don't know that you want to be distinguished on the radio. I think you want to be what you are on the radio.
I'm glad you're not too distinguished.
He's fun. He's lots of fun.
Okay, take it away.
So ask me. I'm going to ask you, what do you think of the tenure of Police Commissioner Ed Davis, who announced that he is leaving within 30 to 60 days to go to Harvard and maybe some other things? What do you think? Has he been good in Boston?
Listen, a couple of things. One, having lived in Boston for the last 30 years or more than 30 years, Ed Davis is a great guy. I mean, and everybody says that, right? Because he actually genuinely is. He's a great guy. He had some issues that preceded him that did not get corrected around the hiring stuff with all white captains across. But on balance, decent person, on balance, had to be a police commissioner who had part of his job orchestrated from the fifth floor of City Hall. So given the constraints and the political realities of
what
Boston...
What constraints did Tom Menino put on him that were of significance?
He had to balance the interface with the unions, which are predominantly white, in a much more sensitive way, so that the issues that Mamlio, for example, the minority officers, correctly raised... Ed Davis was between a rock and a hard place.
By the way, their allegations were twofold. One, that promotions discriminated dramatically their contentions against people of color. And secondly, they also thought that the guy who was demoted because he had failed to arrest the ultimate alleged killer of Amy Lord, it isn't that they thought he hadn't done wrong. They thought that the lack of due process afforded him prior to his demotion, when it was announced at that meeting in South Boston that he had been demoted, was a function of the color of his skin.
And the fact that the two supervisors who were white didn't get any justice. In other words, okay, if we're going to demote people
supervisors
for being
on that first non-arrest.
Exactly. So, and that was reasonable. I mean, I think that was a reasonable thing for people to explore. So, I mean, so to go to your question, Ed Davis, look, a great guy, 7 years. He did remarkably well. He's a decent person. I'd actually
integrity, a lot of integrity.
No. Completely decent person, not a jerk. He had worked in Lowell, and I had actually worked with Ed before he came to Boston in Lowell. He was a great guy.
Well, one of the things people are complaining about is the clearance rate in Boston, and it is
really hard to get
a conviction in many of these murder cases. I have a theory about why that is, but I wonder, I don't think it's anything to do with the police commissioner, but what do you think?
You know what? The clearance rate issue is actually very interesting to me because the two ways that is argued. One, and I've heard Emily talk about this, and I think there's some truth to what she says. She says, well, in the black community, they don't cooperate, right? That's the first line.
Witnesses don't cooperate.
Then I said, well, wait a minute. Hold up. Now, we had Whitey Bulger in South Boston, and that white dude never got a parking ticket. And what about the clearance rates in South Boston with Whitey Bulger? So if we're going to talk about clearance rates and people not cooperating, could black people be any more spectacular than those white folk in South Boston?
Well, that's why I thought it was so unfair, because many times you were asking someone, often someone very young, to testify against the person up for murder who lives three doors down from you.
Absolutely.
And I think if I were that person, I'd be thinking, I testify against this person.
It's absolutely true.
I'm going to be dead.
It's better than that. And there is no witness protection program that exists. So you ask a black girl who was in a car where three of our friends are murdered by men who took out a contract.
Cedric Steele case.
Right.
Yep.
And you say, kid, I want you to come in here. You've got no protection. And frankly, I really don't care about you. I just need a clearance rate because I'm going to do my job, right? And the black kid says, look, I don't watch television. And I'm not crazy. You can't protect me. And I'm supposed to be dumber than you and cooperate? No, in the black community, that's a real thing.
Yeah.
That's a real legitimate concern.
Yeah, but again, I'm not questioning that, of course, and fear is a great motivator, I think, in all of us. But when, at least a couple of years ago, this may have changed, so I say this with some caution, a couple of years ago, our clearance rate did not compare well with the clearance rate in other major urban areas.
That's
obviously
true.
Other urban mayors and police commissioners and DAs figured out how, at least in part, to deal with protection of people who would have the courage to come forward. So we were the outlier to a degree. Why were we that? Why couldn't we provide greater protection or greater security?
You know what I think? That comes back to the racial question around the lack of diversity. There is a complicated, I won't call it bad, we'll simply call it a complicated relationship between the black community and a police department which feels overwhelmingly white Irish. And if there's not good relationship, and frankly, I talked to a number of black officers who are not connected to MAMLEO at all. They had no political agenda. And they said, listen, there's some real issues here.
MAMLEO stands for Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, by the way.
So I think that some part of the difficulty with our clearance rates has to do with the racialized character of the relationship between the black community in this particular case and Boston, because this is, there's some there. It doesn't explain everything, but in fairness, that's a legitimate issue that we can't avoid.
But we also have your fellow man of the cloth, the Reverend Jeff Brown, calling Ed Davis, the commissioner, a class act.
That's
saying
true.
He really worked hard on community policing better than
that's
his predecessors, even Bill Bratton or Paul Evans. So you get a lot of...
That's true. They're not mutually exclusive, though. Jeff Brown's statement is correct, and it doesn't contradict the fact that there were some real issues. Now, the reality is, here's a guy who's resigning. He's going out good. He's got good relations, right? And you want to say good things about him, and we should. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't real issues, notwithstanding. And thank you when Emily was pushing hard, you said, listen, we love Ed Brown. And listen, look, Ed Davis, great guy. great individual, very personal, very professional class act, and there are issues that revolve around race within the department that cannot be avoided because it affects the ability of the police to get their job done. And I'm a taxpayer, so, and I live in Boston.
You know, one last thing about this. A lot of the leading candidates, John Conley, the only one of the leading candidates was the district attorney, Dan Conley, who said for sure he would rehire Davis. The other
He's
ones
a
were
cop.
Saying we should have a – so you think that was it? It was just cop to cop kind of thing?
Well, no, and frankly – As Larry Summers said about someone, it was probably racist in effect, if not in intent. That was code. Look,
what do you mean?
I'm gonna look out for you, white boys, you cops, your unions, right? And I've got to make a political decision between unions, cops, right, and black community. A grieved community.
Well,
and,
also may be that he has to work with a guy
every single day.
I mean, they're social partners against crime, not in crime.
Agreed. Now, I understand that. I understand the political decision and the logic. I'm saying that all decisions have costs. And in the context of the black community, that would be a consideration.
We're talking to Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. Yeah, I know what you're going to bring up. Do it.
Okay. I was going to bring up Pope Francis, who sort of stunned the Catholic world last week when he talked that said that essentially, I'm paraphrasing, that the Catholic Church should be less about condemnation and judgment, particularly of
gay marriage
and abortion and birth control and divorced Catholics,
and
more about compassion and mercy. He did backtrack a little bit on abortion. Well, he didn't backtrack.
He didn't backtrack.
He was never over the track.
Yeah, thank you.
But he just said that the church, you know, he condemned abortion. The church is always going to be pro-life. They can't change their position.
Yeah.
But I wonder what you think about the Pope's move.
Wait a minute. The last time we met and had this conversation, I said, my man is going to tack left. I said that, right? On this radio station, I came, I said, look, y'all, number one, I understand it's not going to be Sean. I love Sean, but it ain't going to be Sean. Then when he came out with he was in Brazil.
Yes, and criticized
when he took on the president
exactly.
of Brazil.
Yep. No, listen, this is consistent. And actually, since I knew I was going to be dealing with Browder today, I did some homework last night.
I actually did some homework last night.
Thank you, right? So here's the narrative, right?
Yep.
Francis is the logical reaction to a 30-year process that you're a good Catholic, right? Where from 65 to 85, right?
Yep.
From 65 to 85, the Roman Catholic Church in the United States went left. Remember their statement on nuclear arms as well as on the economy, right? South and
welfare.
Central America, they were essentially Marxists that went to church.
Yep.
It was called liberation theology.
That's right.
I don't know if none of those people even believed in God, right? Which is why the Catholic Church was lost to the Pentecostals, my people, right? Now, what happens is that Francis is tonally adjusting the reaction which you found in John Paul and Benedict, who were reactions against the shift to the left. So if you look from 65 to 85, right, there is this major shift tack to the left. Liberation theology is going crazy. It's all of South and Central America. Rome in reaction, because you remember one of the first things that John Paul does when he is elevated is that he went to Latin America. Remember he lectured the priests in Nicaragua who were supporting the Sandinistas. It was a very public event where John Paul comes in. And so Francis is simply putting a softer edge on positions which are consistent with John Paul and Benedict.
So you're saying that this is a strategy by the
Cardinals.
Absolutely. I think that they're kind of stunned myself.
Well, no. Look. There are factions within. You got 1.8 billion people. There are going to be a lot of factions.
Yeah.
And in the home office, they are factions. They are stunned because what happens, he is genuinely, because I think he genuinely believes this stuff. In addition, you know, listen. This thing of obsessing, because he's talking to his right.
And that's the word he used, which I love.
Obsessing.
In the interview, he used the word obsession.
No, he's absolutely right. Look, you dudes are obsessing, giving our faith a bad name, because you're crazy. You look crazy. Right? So what he's saying, dude. So he's saying to his right wing, you dudes look nuts. All right? You guys are off the grid. All right? And I'm going to tone this thing down. Now, I'm not going to diverge from the party line, but there is at least a rational way that we can present a position which is unpopular. And you guys are nuts, crude, and you've done the church a disservice. And he's correct.
Speaking of you guys, but what do you think so far of the response, the comments that Cardinal O'Malley has had on what the Pope had to say?
No, I mean,
he hasn't had any.
He hasn't had any. That was my point.
No,
how about the American Council of Bishops? What do you think about their comments on this?
Dolan? No,
there haven't been any.
No.
That was Thursday. I think it came public on Thursday. Right. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. The princes of the church in the United States of America have not said anything.
Well,
it
Dolan
was he
will.
That,
Dolan
it was
will.
He
you
that
know
they
why?
Were speaking to because they're the ones who are obsessed with it.
Absolutely.
Dolan is nothing if not a savvy politician.
No, he's an Irishman.
He'll be right on the Francis bandwagon.
Absolutely.
In
no
just a couple
question.
Of days.
No, in fact, in a couple of hours.
Yeah, he's
very
probably
political. Drafting his statement as we speak.
Well, I am assuming when you call them the right wingers, those are your terms. And by the way, I love the fact that Francis also said that he was no right winger in this interview.
I love
he used
that.
The term right wing.
Oh, yeah.
I'm assuming the reason why Thursday's release of the 12,000 word piece was followed 24 hours later by a denunciation of abortion, which shouldn't have surprised anybody.
Of course.
Was the fact that the American bishops were going absolutely out of their mind.
Excuse me. He's talking to a bunch of gynecologists, and that's who does abortions. They're a bunch of Catholic gynecologists who kind of got lost in the shuffle. If you're speaking to a bunch of gynecologists in Italy, you might weigh in on abortion because consider the audience.
Well, no, in fact, let me say this. Do you think it's an accident that the audience were gynecologists?
On the
does
day
anybody
after they...
does any after he does this number where he smacks around the right?
Yeah.
Do you think does anybody think that this guy?
Maybe you're right.
Speaking of gynecologists,
while like
there
a
are a lot of
convention of gynecologists, that must be kind of weird.
While there are a lot of great quotes from the George W. Bush years, we don't have it right now. But I would suggest you Google George W. Bush and gynecologists for maybe the finest line of George Bush's 8 years
that's
in
right.
the presidency.
Well, you have about, that's a perverse.
Sharing
memory,
the love is what
memory,
he said.
Sharing
in any case,
love.
Can we move back to Boston for a second? The Globe did an editorial over the weekend that I thought was much needed. Boston Strong, this is the title, Boston Strong License Plate, How Should Money Be Spent? And they mentioned that there's a bill on Beacon Hill, 60-plus lawmakers signed on a bill to create a Boston Strong License Plate decorated with a ribbon and the Boston Marathon cover colors. As the editorial says, the plate would cost motorists $50 more than the standard plate. I happen to have a whale plate. I mean, these specialty plates.
What do you need a whale plate for?
I have a whale. No, my kids were young and they wanted
trees,
no
whales.
Excuse. I can't believe I
knew
that.
He was a communist.
Actually, I take that back. Now,
I think he still is.
They ask an important, at the end of this, they talk about all the money going to the one fund. And then let me read from the editorial. That's an understandable impulse, but it would lead to some tough decisions. Should the fund be used to help victims who didn't qualify? And then they ask another couple of questions, ending with this. And is there a point where the community's charitable spirit, so strong in the wake of the bombings, should be funneled to other pressing civic needs? You and we have talked about this since the marathon and since the $70 million and counting has been raised. Is this a good idea? And if money is raised, and I assume it would be a huge seller, if money is raised, what do we do with the money?
Well, let me answer your question with a question. What do we do about the victims of terror that exist in this city who will not, you know, that just happen to have the wrong color of their skin?
Or happen not to have been on Boylston Street.
And happen not to have been on Boylston Street because they ain't got enough money to go down there, right? Now, this is a great question for somebody like Paul Grogan and the Boston Foundation.
Why is that?
Because that is the leading community foundation. They're sort of the public conscience of the philanthropic community. And he and the Boston Foundation should be weighing in because what's interesting to me is that right after when there was all the pile on with all the events around the marathon, Boston Foundation hosted a big thing for the marathon. And I said, wait a minute. So, okay, I get that. Why is there nothing for the black children, the innocent black children who are terrorizing this town? And why is it so difficult, especially for my sophisticated, you know, high paleo liberal elites, you know, the custodians of all things grave and important, that this gets lost? This is a question. In fact, you know what? What's the guy's name that is supervising the fund?
Oh, the guy who did the
lawyer.
Ken Feinberg.
Yes.
Ken Feinberg should come on the show and talk about the moral calculus, which is used in whether white
Well, in all fairness, Ken Feinberg has a mandate. He was given a mandate, a very narrow mandate that I think he brilliantly carried out, as he did in New York City and elsewhere.
Yes, he did.
But the policy decision here, whether it's Beacon Hill in this case, whether it's Tom Menino and Deval Patrick in the case of the one fun Boston thing. There are serious cuts. We raised the issue with virtually every mayoral candidate in months and months.
And
you,
they say?
The whole issue about the mother who can't afford to bury her kid
in
Roxbury.
Thing, that was the thing that Tina Cherry from the Louis D. Brown Peace Foundation was saying when I interviewed her about this a few months ago, was saying that you need to have money up front to bury somebody. And if you are a mother who's broke, here you are at the funeral service for your kid worrying about getting together, and it can be $1,000, getting together the cash to open up a grave. That would be a great place to put this money.
What does the Boston Foundation think about this?
I don't
Why
know.
Are you obsessed with the Boston Foundation?
No. Only because...
Speaking of obsessions.
Because they are a bellwether for the philanthropic community in the city. They're the largest community foundation in the town. And the only reason I'm raising that is if they're the premier community foundation, they set the tone for the other philanthropies. And so someone needs to be an example.
So they should be asked about
this. Yeah, and they're a community foundation.
Yeah.
So since this affects the community, right? And my question is, what's the proper way to discuss it?
What does that mean?
In other words...
I mean, what's the forum for this discussion?
Or what is the appropriate framework for discussing this so that it's not special pleading, but you're saying, okay, we got terror over here, we got terror over here. How do we ignore defenseless children that have to live every night, not one day, every night, ducking and dodging and debating whether or not it's a firecracker or a gunshot? And so I'm simply saying that for sophisticated, decent, fair-minded people, there needs to be a discussion about this, and I thank you for raising it, because...
They should thank the Boston Globe for raising it. We're just doing what they do.
And the other thing that's important to know is that you know, there is victim compensation through the state, but one of the problems is if you are a kid that is in a gang...
You wrote about this brilliantly,
because,
by the way.
You know, because it's hard to stay out of gangs, and you know this much better than I do, but, you get killed, and you're 16, and you were in a gang... You're not going to get the victim compensation because you're not considered to be a victim.
No, and let me say something about the gang thing. What if you're an innocent kid who just got listed as being a gang member?
That's a very good
point. Because you were standing in a corner with three of your buddies coming from the library.
That's a very good point.
And you get FIO'd or ID'd as a gang member because there were three of y'all. You were black, and it was sundown on your way from the Cobham Square Library. No, so at some point, there needs to be a kind of rational conversation about this.
Well, can't guarantee rational. We can guarantee conversation.
How's that? All right. Okay.
Gene Rivers, Reverend Rivers.
Let me ask you. Did I call it on this Francis thing, y'all? My average been pretty good, y'all.
You know, when I every week when I talk to Gene, we get to the end of the conversation, and I think, how would I describe Gene Rivers? I don't know if distinguished is the first
word. No, that's not the word. No. I'm black.
You're digging a hole for yourself.
Let me tell you, Margaret. Black.
Sorry.
Hey, Gene, we'll talk to you next
Monday. You're too enthusiastic.
Thank you, people.
Okay, thank you very much for being with us, Gene. As always, he's here every Monday at 1 o'clock. Who's here tomorrow at 1 o'clock, Jim? Do you know?
Yes, Joe Avalone, who is a candidate for the Democratic nomination. We're having a whole series of all the Democratic candidates running for governor every Tuesday at 1.
Thank you very much. I was just checking to see if you were paying attention. When we come back, we'll go to the television winners and losers. Last night, Emmy Awards, the 65th Annual Emmy Awards. And we're also going to hear about the upcoming season, what you should watch and what you can forget about. Bob Thompson from Syracuse joins us for that conversation. Up next, WGBH.
The onslaught of DVRs and time-shifted TV viewing has threatened the model of TV advertising. But one Lexington-based company is experimenting with a way to make watching commercials online worth your while by paying viewers to watch the ads. Or kind of.
We're not paying users to watch ads. We're giving users the opportunity to watch ads on their own schedule.
I'm reporter Christina Quinn with that story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Celebrity Series of Boston, celebrating its 75th season of presenting great artists in classical music, jazz, dance, spoken word, and more. Tickets to more than 70 performances are on sale now. More at celebrityseries.org. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Last night's Emmy Awards were universally panned. The Daily Beast writes that host Neil Patrick Harris's opening monologue was, quote, the peak embodiment of giving people exactly what they do not want. There was one funny moment. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler harassed host Neil Patrick Harris from the audience. Listen.
Take your pants off. Take your pants off. And twerk it.
Yeah.
I come to award shows for the twerking.
No, stop. No.
Twerk it.
I am not twerking. I'm not going to do that. That would be degrading.
Yeah, it might be degrading, but we would be degrateful.
That was about it for last night. The Atlantic writes the ceremony was boring, jokes weren't funny, the wrong people won the awards, and that the internet is mad at Jeff Daniels for winning Best Male Actor. Well, joining us online for his take on last night's Emmys is Bob Thompson. He's the director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Bob, it's great to talk to you again.
You too. By the way, the best thing about that Tina Fey, Amy Poehler thing is they were wearing 3D glasses while
they were. Yes, they were. I forgot that. That's exactly right.
So, Bob Thompson, were they that bad in your estimation? I mean, you're the expert here.
Well, you know, these award shows like Emmys and Oscars, which have a certain kind of tradition to uphold, you're not going to see the kind of things you'd see at the VMAs or at some of these other award shows, which do more outrageous kinds of things. You know, it's basically they got to get through a bunch of lists of nominees. They've got to give the awards. There's only so much they can do. But yes, I would say this was a really dull evening. And what's interesting is when you look at the nominees, some of the greatest television storytelling ever done in the medium in this country in its entire history, and the award show that is celebrating and giving awards to this brilliant period of TV that we're in now, was really kind of dull, and not for lack of talent. Neil Patrick Harris knows how to do an award show. He's a funny guy. The material was just horrid. Even his big production number in the middle, the number in the middle of the show, as it was titled, really just kind of fell flat.
Yeah, but that's like Colin Powell saying, "I didn't write that speech in front of the National Security Council at the UN 11 years ago." He has, you know, I thought the only really great, well, maybe not only, Merritt Weaver, who won for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy from Nurse Jackie, she gave one of the shortest and greatest acceptance speeches ever. Here she is.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much. Thank you so much. I gotta go. Bye.
She didn't even take time to thank her accountant or her agent, but what is wrong with this woman?
Well, now, you know, that was funny, and everybody's pointing that as the one, like, delightful moment of the entire drawn-out evening. And I think we've all fantasized about doing something like that if we were up there getting an award. However, if you're one of those, if you're one of her loved ones, or if you're one of the people who have worked really hard to help her get where she's gotten, as funny as that was, you know, sometimes when you get up there, it's boring, it's dull, it's all the rest of it. But, you know, sometimes mom and dad need to be thanked.
You know, the thing, I cannot tell a lie. I watched every minute from 8 to 9, or maybe 8:05, because the football game went late, till 9. And then I switched to Breaking Bad, because I couldn't wait to see it on DVR. And speaking of Breaking Bad, it wins Best Drama. Modern Family wins Best Comedy. But the conventional wisdom is all the other predicted winners did not do as people expected them to do. Did they make the right choices in the big awards, Bob Thompson?
Well, by saying did they make the right choices, it implies that somehow the Emmys are about giving awards to the best shows by some objective scientific.
That was the implication, and it is wrong, correct?
Right, and we can't do that. I mean, you can put, I've said this 100 times before, you can put a substrate into a Bunsen burner that burns a certain color, you know what it is. You can't do that with a DVD.
Yeah.
So, the critics' awards are what the critics think are best, and the ratings are what the people think are best. And the Emmy nominations are interesting because they tell you how the industry, people who are inside and who do all this stuff, have decided to award these things. The other comparison I always make is it would be if I said to you, what's your favorite color? And you would say purple. And I would say, no, you got that wrong. It's blue, and I can't believe you didn't get that right. So did the right shows win. Not all the shows I would have given the awards to won, but I'm not a member of the Academy.
Yeah, but let's take one example. Every person I know, and I amongst them, thought that Bryan Cranston, who I think has won 3 Best Actor awards for Breaking
right.
Bad, was clearly going to win his 4th because the show is about to go off the air next Sunday, which we'll talk to you about in a couple of minutes. Jeff Daniels is great in Newsroom. But Brian, the feeling was it's the end of his reign. He's going to get number 4. There had to be a strategic decision made by voters not to give him his 4th.
Before we get to Bob Thompson, I'm getting emails from people like Julie who said, talking about Jeff Daniels from Flap in Terms of Endearment, that was the guy who played the creepy husband, from Flap to Dumb and Dumber to hunky Brian-esque newsman, Brian Williams-esque newsman. He's absolutely fantastic.
He is fantastic.
So some people totally agree with you.
No, by the way,
ahead,
I didn't
Bob.
Say he wasn't good, but Bryan Cranston, this was his swan song on Breaking Bad. What happened there?
Well, I think it's true. Although, isn't it Breaking Bad is still on now and next week, which
yes.
means it's in 2000. So aren't they going to be eligible again for the next batch of Emmys?
Oh, I don't know. Are they? Because
well,
this season is next year's, is part of next year's. Maybe you're right.
Yeah, I don't know. You'd better check that out. I'm not sure I'm right about that. I could be wrong. But anyway, needless to say, I also thought Bryan Cranston was going to win Best Actor. The performance he has been putting season after season, including the eligible episodes this time, have been so extraordinary, so Shakespearean. So, I mean, there seems like nothing like it out there. So I thought he would get it as well. But there's a number of ways that this could have gone down. For example, Bryan Cranston actually might have split the vote with the same kind of people who might have had a tendency to vote for Kevin Spacey in House of Cards, Damian Lewis in Homeland. And what might have happened is that these blocks of votes that go in a certain direction may have split. And then you've got the smaller but enthusiastic group who really like Jeff Daniels in Newsroom. And they may have, this thing, when it all ultimately goes down, it's like a student council election.
You know, by the way, our colleagues have done the research you asked us to do in a nanosecond. And the answer is he is eligible, Bryan Cranston, for the 2014 Emmys for these
right,
final.
Right, so they'll get another chance. And that's why Mad Men has now done what Breaking Bad did. They're breaking up their final season, so they're going to be eligible, if I'm not mistaken, into 2015.
And, of course, the best supporting actress was the woman from Breaking Bad, Anna Gunn. And I assume you think that she got a well-deserved bit of recognition there.
Right. She, I think the acting across the board in that show is so extraordinary. And I think people weren't surprised by that. But how the supporting actor did not go to who they expected it to in many cases in Breaking Bad. But, you know, that's how these things are.
Well, that's the guy, that Brian Carnevale from Boardwalk Empire. There seemed to be a big flap about him. Was he somehow undeserving of the recognition, Bob Thompson?
I don't think. I look down all of these major awards, and I don't. There's nobody in here I point to and say they don't belong on that list.
Okay.
I mean, these are really solid performances and solid shows. I think the favorite was, once again, Aaron Paul in Breaking Bad, who,
Jesse
alongside
Pinkman.
of Bryan Cranston, has just done these extraordinary performances. But, you know, one of the good things that happens with this, everybody's been talking about Breaking Bad. Maybe this gets a few more people to try out the Newsroom, which is, I think, worth trying out. I think Jeff Daniels does it's a preachy Aaron Sorkin program, but preachy can be done really well,
yeah.
And I think it's done really well in that show.
You know, speaking of Bryan Cranston, well, it's a drop off topic. When James Gandolfini died, we spoke to you shortly thereafter, and one of the things I asked you, Bob Thompson, was did anyone ever see him in a television show or a movie where they didn't think Tony Soprano? I saw this past weekend, I saw Bryan Cranston as LBJ in All the Way at the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge.
Yep.
And he is so brilliant, not that Gandolfini wasn't. In a nanosecond, at least I forgot that he was Walter White and he became LBJ. But what does he do in television next, Bryan Cranston? To separate it. Does he have to do a comedy again? Does he have to do Malcolm in the Middle Returns?
Maybe the reunion show of Malcolm in the Middle, which, by the way, I cannot, when I stumble upon that now, I can't watch it. I mean, it's like the cognitive disconnect in my brain I can't bear it.
Hey, before we leave the Emmys, we want to talk about upcoming new shows and returnees in a couple of seconds. Was there somebody who wasn't supposed to win who you said to yourself last night, this is great, it's about time he or she got recognition?
Well, I have to say, I said that about to myself about Jeff Daniels. I think The Newsroom is an underrated show, and I was really glad to see that go to him. Other than that, I think Julia Louis-Dreyfus in Veep, this is now her second award.
Fabulous.
The fact that that show that doesn't get talked about a whole lot
keeps
getting awarded is also probably a good thing, too.
Here's Jeff Daniels. Before we go ahead, here's Jeff Daniels in his acceptance speech joking about his age. Here he is.
Well, crap. Didn't expect this. I usually don't win anything. The last thing I won was in a few years ago for Squid and the Whale. I won the Best Actor Over 50 from the AARP.
That's a great line.
Oh, I forget about that performance. He was terrific in the Squid and the Whale, too. That was a sad movie, but he was great.
He's a really great actor.
Yeah, he's a really great actor. I remember him, like I said, years ago in Terms of Endearment when he was the creepy wife to the woman that died of cancer. Remember that? And he was cheating on her and all that kind of
stuff. Did you see The Atlantic this morning, its review of the Emmy Awards, Bob Thompson?
I didn't, no.
The Atlantic trashes them like almost everybody else and then proposes, I may get the words wrong, that instead of this Emmy thing, it's time to end the Emmys and have what they're calling, I think, a national television festival. I love this, where every station, and I'm mostly getting it right, puts together their greatest hits from the year, whether it's documentaries, whether it's shows, whatever it is, I guess excerpts from all these things. And maybe in January, each of the station rolls out the best of what they did in the year before, considering that most of us, probably unlike you, don't get to see 90%. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I love the idea of us getting to see programming that, you know, that we don't otherwise get to see. I don't know how that idea takes the place of the Emmy Awards. That's a whole different idea, an interesting one. I'm not sure you'd get the, big mass audience to watch it, but it's always nice to see programming that most people don't get to see.
We're talking with Bob Thompson from Syracuse University. I think we've wrapped up the Emmys. Let's move on to the season that's coming. I just got an email from somebody telling me The White Queen on Starz, this is from Scott, is the best show of the season. I never even heard of it. Is that a good show? And what are the other ones that we should definitely tune into,
well,
Bob Thompson?
That is an interesting show, but it is also interesting that you say that you've never even heard of it, in that, you know, once upon a time, by the fourth week of a new season, everybody, whether they deliberately watched it or not, tended to know about all the new programs. There were only three networks. These things were on. You hardly could avoid them. Now, you've got a lot of shows that will go, a season, two seasons, before most people are even talking about it. Even the sainted Breaking Bad, which now everybody is genuflecting about, in its first couple of seasons, that was still, you know, a show that was kind of slowly building up audiences and all the rest of it. So the idea now of checking out how a show does, and if it's not getting high ratings in its first two episodes, canceling it, really is not a good strategy, because it takes people a long time to, I mean, most people don't even know half the channels they've got on their cable and satellite dial, much less what the new shows are that are coming out. The show Scandal, almost everybody that watches it absolutely loves it. I asked my 120 students on Monday how many people had heard of it, forget seen it, and I would say 90% of them had never even heard of it.
Wow.
Wait, this is in a class on television?
This is in a class on television with people majoring in television who plan to go out to L.A. and make television.
Oh, God. That's a bad sign,
I guess.
Well,
I hope you grade on a curve, Bob Thompson. So, Bob, if you could pick, let's say, three or four shows that are either returning or premiering in the next couple of weeks, as a lot of them are doing both, what's at the top of your list?
Well, there's a show that starts tonight, as a matter of fact, I think, on NBC called The Blacklist, which is kind of interesting. NBC, of course, already has this Hannibal Lecter show, and this is James Spader, who used to be the most wanted FBI bad guy, and now he's helping the FBI solve problems from a bad guy's perspective. Where it's going to go, I don't know, but the first episode's look kind of good.
He's also a great,
CW,
he's a pretty good actor.
I love him.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape was him, right?
Right, and he, of course, on the
Office.
Boston Legal, the Boston Legal, his
Boston Legal
with Shatner were so memorable.
Yeah. What else?
And the CW, which is not generally a place that generates lots of hits and critical acclaim, has a it's kind of like Beverly Hills 90210 1557 style. It follows Mary Queen of Scots, and it's very
really?
Kind of young, but compared to the Tudors crossed with 90210 and lots of really beautiful royalty in it, but it's got a certain appeal and is a little little different. And then this show, The Goldbergs, on ABC, kind of like The Wonder Years, but it takes place in the 80s instead of the late 60s and 70s. That seems to have some potential.
How many hours a week do you watch television, Bob?
Oh, Thompson? Man, it is getting so hard just to keep up now. I generally have the DVR going all evening and spend a good portion of my business workday watching TV.
So you know, I read somewhere where the Goldbergs is, in fact, named after the guy who wrote the show or created the show. He's done a sitcom kind of about his own family growing up in the
80s. Yeah, I think there are autobiographical elements to it, which was true of Everybody Hates Chris, and I think was true to some extent with the Wonder Years. I think autobiography works with those kinds.
Yeah, I love the
Wonder
Years.
Okay, I don't know if I've asked you this before, but now it's timely. Final question for me, Bob Thompson. Do you watch Breaking Bad live and DVR the first Homeland of the season, or do you watch Homeland and DVR Breaking Bad?
No question. You watch Breaking Bad live whenever it is possible.
Bob Thompson, it's great to talk to you as always.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bob Thompson is the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University.
And by the way, he's going to join us next Monday, the day after the finale of Breaking Bad, to break it down for all of us who will be in mourning.
Yeah, it'll be our memorial service.
And it will.
Jim will weep. And
it will, actually.
I've missed the whole phenomenon. I'll try to catch up between now and then. Okay, when we come back, we're going to look at an unlikely consequence that surveillance cameras have had in the workplace. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is an exceptional year for people who follow local politics.
WGBH News political analyst David Bernstein.
It is the first open mayoral election in a generation. It will decide a lot of things about the future of the city. There's also just a lot of very practical interest about how things will or will not improve over the coming years based on decisions made this year.
Get to know all the Boston mayoral candidates online at WGBHnews.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Fruitlands Museum in Harvard, Mass., presenting the Craft Festival at Fruitlands in conjunction with Worcester Center for Crafts. Over 30 artists will be selling fine crafts under the tent, rain or shine, on September 28th and 29th. Fruitlands.org. And Genealogy Roadshow. Follow along on an emotional journey that uses history and science to uncover some fascinating family stories. Catch the series premiere of Genealogy Roadshow, Monday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A recent poll finds that 78% of Americans think surveillance cameras are a good idea, but that's when it comes to public safety. How people feel about them in the workplace is less clear. Nonetheless, our guest Andrew McAfee has some interesting data on the effect that this kind of surveillance has on workplace behavior. It's the subject of a recent study that he and his colleagues concluded. Andrew McAfee is a research scientist at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Andrew, tell people what you checked out and what you found.
Well, first of all, we didn't use cameras. We were using data supplied by point-of-sale terminals inside sit-down restaurants, inside table service restaurants. These would comb through the data that the restaurants generate and set up red flags related to theft, in this case, by employees. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to use the word surveillance because to me that implies someone watching behavior that we consider to be private. I'll use the term monitoring instead, which is a company looking to make sure its employees are doing a good job and doing the right job.
And is monitor, when you say monitor, when you say there's no expectation of privacy, in the instances that you were looking at, Were the employees all aware that this monitoring was going on? Obviously, they had to be, well, right? For it to have the effect you're going to describe in a minute.
Well, they're absolutely aware that they're using a point-of-sale terminal system. These are the things that we see servers tapping onto all the time when we go to eat. They're absolutely aware that, that every transaction that they do is recorded in that point-of-sale system. What we were able to study is what happens after each site, and we studied almost 400 different locations, after each site starts getting weekly reports that highlight these problems, these red flags, which are almost surely not due to any inadvertent behavior. They're very clearly instances of employee theft or misbehavior.
So what'd you find from your research, Andrew?
We found We found two things that I find surprising. The first is that theft absolutely went down, but it didn't go down by very much. It wasn't like you could easily see the money walking out the door. So the average decrease in weekly theft was only about $25. Now, that's not very much at all. The astonishing thing to me, though, was that after this system was put in place, the increase in revenue on average at each site was about $3,000. Now, that's a really serious difference in the overall revenue of a restaurant location, really enough to make the difference between profit and loss.
Well, Andrew, correct me if I'm wrong here. My understanding is that when these people in these restaurants knew that they were being monitored, the servers pulled back on their unethical practices and behaved better as workers, so that the monitoring changed their behavior in a pretty dramatic way.
That's our impression from the data that we've looked at and the people that we talk to, is that people say, well, you know, I that avenue for making money is shut off for me, and people are pretty clearly aware that this kind of stuff is going on. Maybe I should rededicate myself to doing my job down the straight and narrow and doing it better. One of the other really interesting things that we saw that I wasn't anticipating is that tip percentage actually went up significantly after this technology was put in place. Now, it's hard for me to believe that that would happen if the waiter suddenly got surly or disgruntled or started hating their jobs more.
Yeah.
Probably show up in a decrease in tips. What we see instead is the opposite. I tell a pretty happy story about people doing their jobs better and more correctly, and both the employer and the employee and the customer in this case benefiting from it.
Well, there was a great anecdote in here about I never heard of this, the bartender scam, where the bartender doesn't charge for an extra round of drinks and says, but just take care of me with a tip. I mean, I didn't know they were doing this. I used to be a bartender. But I guess the payoff, they've stop doing that now, pretty much. What kind of restaurants were these, by the way? Were they like mid-level? They were not fast food. They were like mid-level, sit-down table restaurants, like an Applebee's kind of deal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So think of restaurant chains like Chili's. And I can't reveal which ones. Chili's was not part of this study.
Okay.
But think
but
of
like
that kind of price range table service, like you say, not fast food. And one of the things that we learned with this research is, like you say, people can get incredibly devious with ways to steal on the job while they're working in a restaurant.
Like what?
There's the overtip scam that you mention is one, which is the bartender really not charging you for all the drinks that you've had, and then sliding your check to you at the end and with the wink saying, hey, take care of me. And then you just write them an extra big tip, but the restaurant doesn't make money in that case. The bartender does. We came across an even more elaborate one called the wagon wheel scam, which basically involves selling the same glass of orange juice or cup of coffee to table after table after table during a brunch, for example, and taking the cash that the customers pay you, putting it in your pocket, and then electronically transferring that glass of orange juice from table to table to table. Actually amazed. It's amazing how on top of things you have to be to even pull this off as a server. So like I say, my impression is what's going on is that the servers are reallocating that effort away from deviousness and toward good old-fashioned good service.
I can't believe I never thought of that when I was a waiter, actually. Now, Andrew McAfee, you sound surprised by the results. I'm not, actually. You are?
You're not.
You are?
I'm surprised by the magnitude. $3,000 is somewhere around 7% of the average revenue of these locations that we studied. That is really not a drop in the bucket.
No.
Right, especially since the profit margin. You make a good point. It's the magnitude that's shy. Because the profit margins of these places is quite small. The ones, the twos, the 3%, right?
Yeah, absolutely. These have profit margins kind of like supermarkets do, mm-hmm. very, very thin. And in particular, the drink revenue went up by about $1,000 a week across our locations. And if you have spent any time in these environments, that's where a lot of the scamming happens for a bunch of reasons. Drinks and bars and that part of the operation is where a lot of the bad behavior goes on.
So what's the moral of the story for businesses outside of the industry that you were doing your research in? What should people take away from this?
It's really easy to tell sinister stories about monitoring and surveillance, and especially in the wake of some of the recent revelations, I don't want to be surveilled either. Monitoring is different, and when monitoring is done well, I think the moral of this story is that it can lead to better results for the employers, for the customers, and if it's not handled incorrectly, it can help the employees actually allocate their attention and their initiative in the right areas.
So one last thing. I just want to be clear before we take some phone calls here at 877-301-8970, Andrew. When you say the difference between monitoring and surveillance, there's no cameras there. They're just taking a stock of what's lost every week. That's what you're talking about in terms of monitoring. That's what that means, right?
Monitoring is watching somebody's on-the-job performance. And no one would suggest that you should never monitor employees. That would be ridiculous as a management philosophy. For me, surveillance is watching behavior that I think is actually being done in private where I might have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Okay.
I don't see that a waiter at a restaurant has an expectation of privacy about comping the check.
McAfee, before you go away, though, when you gave the moral of the story about monitoring and the savings for the employers and the ethical behavior and how much better the performance is, the flip side of that moral is without monitoring that the employees are sort of whatever we can stuff in our pockets, literally
That's
or
right.
figuratively.
That's what I was wondering.
Isn't that the
are
moral
stealing,
of the story?
Are they stealing food? We didn't get around to that. Are they stealing food, put little shrimp in one pocket, little, you know, little tenderloin beef in the other one?
Well, we couldn't observe that. And the monitoring is the moral for me is not that all people are evil and you can't trust anybody and you have to watch everybody like a hawk. The moral for me is that the situation is a very powerful thing. And when you present these opportunities for people to do the wrong thing, in some cases they will. That's why that's why the cash register was invented, because the open drawer full of cash is just too big a temptation.
Okay.
Let's take the temptation away.
Andrew McAfee, thanks.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. I much appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Andrew McAfee is a research scientist at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. So what do you guys think at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970? You know what I immediately thought of is you know, in most offices, you have these big supply rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take pens and you can take computer paper and you can take legal pads and all those kinds of things. And I think most of us just go in there and take them. But if you knew—
We don't take them to go sell them out on the street.
No.
You take them if you're a person who does some work outside the office.
Well, it's legitimate to take them. But I think I would want to explain to somebody, because I print out tons of stories at home, you take a big wad of computer paper, which I think is okay. But I think I'd feel like I wanted to tell somebody I was doing that, or, you know, sign list of a computer wad of paper, something
like
that.
No, even though Andrew didn't say this, our number is 877-301-8970, and I don't want to put words in his mouth. I'll put words in my own. The moral of the story is the one I said at the end. If you're not monitored, the average employee is going to take whatever isn't nailed down.
Well,
and the moral of the story is if you think you are being monitored, which is the term of art, then the answer is you're going to be much more careful and perform better. I mean, that it is a very sad state of
but
affairs,
you know,
but that is what this thing says.
I'm thinking with bartenders, and you used to be a bartender. I used to be a bartender.
No, I wasn't. I was a waiter and a busboy.
Okay, well, I was a bartender. You know, you pour in the drinks. And some places actually have you pour an exact jigger of, you know, an ounce and a half. But if you have a lot of latitude there, you could see where the bartenders could kind of – I mean, who's really going to check whether there's an extra two shots missing from the bottle of scotch at the end of the night?
Well, can I also tell you what's troubling about this? And you mentioned the example of how should I put it, taking office supplies home. Sometimes things just appear. For example, I worked in the Catskills, you know, and I worked at the resort when I was a kid. Sometimes I would get back to my room and there'd be maybe 10 steaks
well, exactly.
that ended up in my room. I have no idea how they got there. And I wouldn't, 877, happens to be true, 877, I wasn't paid that much, 301 877 877-377-301 8970. Do you find this surprising? Do you take the same moral of the story? Andrew is clearly a cup half full kind of guy.
Yeah.
I, in this case, am a cup half empty. Essentially, the employees were taking whatever they could, lying their way through the day until they realized they're monitored, and all of a sudden their behavior improved dramatically. What a surprise.
You know, also, sometimes you really get hungry in a shift and you just have to, like, steal one of those baked potatoes. You know
it's
I mean?
Not stealing, by the way.
It is stealing. I never did it, of
course.
What
we called it eating, Marjorie. That's
ice cream sundaes, a little extra hot fudge on there just to get you through to the 11 o'clock when you can go home and relax.
Let's go to Ryan in a car. You were first on Boston Public Radio. What do you make of this survey, Ryan?
Well, I just think, you know, I used to work. I was a bar back in a bar. And, you know, there were bartenders that did that. And I think the attitude just kind of was that, like, since the restaurant only pays them, like, $2.50 an hour, right, that, you know, they feel the need to do that. And I feel like if restaurants maybe age a little bit, people might be less likely to do that.
I tend to agree with you. I mean, this is a low-wage industry.
I'm not defending it.
But
Ryan, you can make a ton of money in a night as a bartender on tips, though.
I mean, you can, but, you know, I don't know. I feel like it was just, I don't know, the attitude towards the restaurant.
Yeah.
Ryan, you're basically saying it's war. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, kind of, exactly.
War, thank you very much for the call. That's why I said, I didn't mean to insult. I hope I didn't insult Andrew McAfee at all. What is surprising? I mean, it's important that the data be hard data. What is surprising about this, that when an employee is monitored, he or she operates much more ethically than when he or she is not being monitored? Are you surprised by that?
Like I said, I thought it'd be like a little baked potato there, a little ice cream sundae here.
Yeah, it's the magnitude. That's the point. When a bartender is routinely saying
or once or twice a week saying, hey, I'm not going to charge you for the extra drinks, just take care of me, that is kind of stepping over the bounds, wouldn't you say?
No, that's the point he makes and you're making it true. It's not so much that the behavior change, it's the magnitude of the behavioral change. That is a very, very fine point.
Viziani, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, from Malden. Did I butcher that? Is that wrong or right?
Hi, Viziani.
Hi, Marjorie.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
So, I'm a senior at college, and during my first and second year, I used to be a server. And I work in different places. I work in very high fine dining restaurants, and I also work in chain restaurants. And I think that this study is not very holistic because it's not like the opportunity you make people behave bad. I think that is the class of people that's working the chain restaurants. You know what I'm saying?
You're saying that essentially it's a self-selecting group. It's lower income people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, but the flip side, I'm not sure to use your term, it's the class of people. I think what Ryan said a minute ago is when you're making a couple of bucks an hour and maybe the tips aren't what Marjorie says they can be, that may be a self-selecting group more than the, you know, the quote kind of person who works there. No, isn't that a legitimate point?
But it's just someone that has an education. Yeah. And, like, not books education, but education from home. It's not because he's not making money that he's going to steal the first opportunity they have.
But, Viziani, in the spirit of full disclosure, as I say, I came from a pretty my mother was pretty ethical, and I did have a number of steaks appeared in my
That's
room
right. All bets were
when
off.
I was in the Catskills on more nights than one. And I was paid very little. Viziani, you make a fine point, though. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
There was that incident, too, when we were spotted carrying the computer into the parking lot.
By the way, that you know, you do this kind of thing, and then all of a sudden
the security guards.
That is thoroughly
Jim
untrue.
Jim said he was just borrowing it. Just some work in the car.
I am not taking reams of paper from the second floor here, Marjorie.
I'm going to have to start
some my colleagues.
You know, I figured it was okay because I'm taking it home to print stores. Maybe I have to check a box.
You want to know in a serious
to make
thing?
Sure.
By the way, I have been at workplace. I haven't done it here, but this is a totally true story.
Took about five pens.
No,
today.
When I've taken something that is work related, but yep. It's more than I would ordinarily take, and I almost always write an email. I'm serious. I send an email to the boss to cover yourself, so you just know that
when you are taking computers and printers,
I didn't take computers.
Right. That's what he says now.
A couple of states.
Rick,
a long time ago.
Rick from Hopkinton, what do you think about people taking stuff from the restaurants?
Well, my point, actually, I'm calling about just being observed, Marjorie. One thing I've suggested to a few people in the state of Massachusetts is now with the technical ability to go from point A to point B because you have your easy pass or they're about to do no tolls that they scan your license plate. They really don't need to patrol the Mass Pike any longer for speeders because from point A to point B, say it takes 10 minutes at 65 miles an hour.
Right. If you made it 9 minutes, you violate. But Rick, we are out of time, and I have very good news for you. Either the SJC or an appellate court ruled about a decade ago in Massachusetts that the electronic ticket giving, by purely that, as opposed to taking a picture of your license plate when you run a toll like Marjorie used to do, they can't send you a ticket. They can't arrest you for it.
You know,
so you're safe for the time being. Rick, thank you.
Scuff laws
no,
here.
We're not.
I'm running the tolls, and
no,
you're
not.
Stealing computers.
I've never taken anything more from workplace than a few
Jim.
Dollars worth of stuff.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to have a lot in the mayor's race, of course, which is tomorrow in Boston. Also going to interview Joe Avalone, who's running for the Democratic nomination for governor. So tune in for that. We're taking exit polls in the mayor's race, talking about famous movie mayors as well. We'll also hear from the candidates. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Brady. And tomorrow, call in if you're voting. We'd love to hear reports from the polling places as well. We'll see you tomorrow noon. Bye.